This is the Rugby Centurions podcast.
Welcome to another show with me, Martin Cross, and Rugby Centurions, Chris Evans. Brian Habana blazed his way to rugby greatness in a stellar 14-year international career, scoring an incredible 67 tries for the Springboks in 124 appearances. World Cup, Tri-Nations, Super Rugby, Currie Cup, French Championship, European Cup. His list of honours is almost without equal. But also, how many other players have competed in a head-to-head race against a cheetah? But it was the ultimate prize in 2007 that was the first port of call.
Yeah, Martin, Chris, absolutely brilliant to be on here, the Rugby Centurions podcast. I think the platform that the Centurions have created is really great. So it's great to be on the podcast. I'm probably following in some pretty big footsteps, over the course of the last couple of weeks. But an absolute privilege and honour to be a Centurion. I think to have represented your country once, for any player is incredible. To go on to then do it 100 times is pretty special. To go on to be at a World Cup and winning that for the first time was incredibly special. I think, for us as a country, South Africa, we'd gone from the doldrums of, World Rugby in 2003, getting kicked out in the quarterfinals against New Zealand. I got my first test match in 2004 under the new regime that was Jake White. We had a pretty interesting journey, to be honest. People only remember the good times and the fun times. A year out, from France in 2007, we, lost 49-0 against the Aussies in Brisbane. Had a pretty poor run for about six games in a row. Jake almost got fired. John was sort of told, why is he still captaining when there's better players involved? So I think for us, there wasn't one specific moment in 2007. It was that journey of getting to know each other extremely well, the journey of getting to understand what needs to be done, the sacrifice, the hard work, the dedication, effort, that's sort of a non-negotiable if you want to be successful in any realm of life. But when that final whistle went, and I think it's not just about the emotion and the joy and the exuberance, it's a pure sense of relief, knowing all the effort, hard work and sacrifice that everyone's put in, that your family and friends have put in. And then getting to that point of going through this journey, going through the highs and the low, and realizing a dream that for me had been instilled back in 95. For many of these players, guys like us coming to the end of their career, just realizing that we've now achieved something that no other South African side had achieved before, winning the World Cup outside of South African shores for the first time, was incredibly special. And in that winning moment, the bond that it does then create, not only for that time period, but for the rest of your life, is something that I think each and every one of us in that squad was extremely grateful to have been a part of.
We spoke to John Schmidt, I guess, probably on our first podcast, and he spoke about this, great team ethos, almost like a team of captains, he said, where actually felt that, yes, he was one captain, but one of many on the pitch. How did, from your perspective, when you look at John's leadership through that sort of prism, how was it to play with him and under him when he was captain, Brian?
Chris, any team for me, whether it be sports, whether it be in business, for any team to become successful, you need good leaders and not just one person standing up and saying, okay, listen, I'm going to lead from the front. You all follow me. Yes, you have a coach and a captain who does the pragmatic approach and be at the forefront and held in accountable for being that. But each and every one of us as individuals actually needed to be a leader, first and foremost, for yourself. Then in your sort of mini unit. So for me, the back three with Percy Montgomery and JP Peterson. Then as a backs unit, we had the likes of Percy, Butch James, Bridget Prayer. And then the backs come as, together with the forwards. And then all together, those arrows are then facing the right direction. I mean, being in a country as unique as South Africa, where we have so many different cultures, different way of life, to then have someone like John who fully encompasses and brings together all those various elements and makes sure that not only is he communicating and leading, not by words, but by actions as well, really meant that the ethos of the team was grounded on the fact that be accountable, take responsibility, but be a leader in your own position first. And I think in so doing, by John laying that foundation, laying the manner and example that he set in being able to holistically bring everyone together, not want to be the best kicker because that was Percy Montgomery's role, not want to be the best line-out jumper because that was, Victor Matfield and Bucky's Buerta's role. And I think so it was incredibly great for me. Myself and Don have remained really good mates post our rugby careers. A guy I love, he's a guy who I think has gone into business and has transferred a lot of those leadership qualities into the business environment and has become extremely successful in that as well.
In that tournament, you equaled Jonah Lomu's 8-try record in a single Rugby World Cup tournament. Was he someone in your formative years that influenced you a great deal?
Jonah changed the way rugby was seen. He became the game's first global superstar. And I think, his incredible feats on the field were sort of matched by his humility off it. And, I wasn't Jonah's size. I wasn't, his way of doing things. I was very different in my demeanor as a wing. So I didn't want to be compared to Jonah, because even I look back to this day and I'm like, I can't be compared to the great Jonah Lomu. He changed the way rugby is seen globally. He absolutely, as a 19-year-old, became a superstar in every way possible. And I was like, well, I can't be compared to Jonah, because there is only ever going to be one Jonah Lomu. Was he a hero? Without a doubt. Being South African, I'll never forget. I was fortunate enough to go to a lot of the games in the Rugby World Cup in 95. And my dad actually took us to the All Black team hotel, myself and my brother, and we were sort of getting signatures, and everyone wanted Jonah Lomu's signature, which was very difficult to come by because, he'd already got to pretty decent levels of stardom. And I think we'd been there for about 3-4 hours and, just hadn't seen Jonah. And just before we left, we went to the bathroom. And as myself and my brother were leaving the bathroom, in comes this man mountain that is Jonah Lomu into the bathroom, and myself, my brother, jaws drop. And it was the most awkward experience because we want this guy's signature, but he's now going to the bathroom. You're not quite the appropriate manner in which to get that. But the amount of respect I had for Jonah is inconceivable. And I don't want to be compared to him, because I think he deserves to be in a league all on his own. Grateful that I was able to score an equal tries, a try record at a tournament. Was it as good as Jonah's? I don't know. But I think, again, the esteem in which I held him was pretty high.
Other than the bathroom meetings, did you get a chance to meet him again, Brian?
I actually got to meet him in France. We were both Adidas athletes, and I actually got to meet him at the Adidas Hub in Paris in 2007. And just, his humility, his genuine approach to life was really palpable and something that I really enjoyed and experienced. And what a man. So grateful for that meeting. I got to meet him one or two times after that, post that tournament. And what an exceptional human being.
At the end of that year, at the end of that tournament, you're voted IRB World Player of the Year. To get that recognition, obviously, is amazing. But also, were you aware of perhaps the role model that you were starting to become?
So I sort of feel a little bit embarrassed that I actually did win that title in 2007, because there could have easily been 5 or 6 other players from that 2007 group that could have much easily have won it. I look at the likes of Jean Smith, who was incredible in that World Cup. Feridu Priya, who probably had one of the best tournaments the scrum off has ever had. That game against England in the pool stages was one of the most cleanest performance by a nine that I've ever witnessed. John Smith and his captaincy, Victor Matfield getting man of the match in the final, Percy Montgomery not missing a kick at Stade de France. So I think, I feel a little bit embarrassed, because yes, you score tries and, people see the individual aspect of that, but not one of those tries would have been possible without my teammates, without my coaches. So it is awkward, and you sort of understand what you're able to do as an individual and you play your part in that team. But I think the beauty for me about rugby is that it is really a team sport, and you're only as strong as your weakest link. And in that 2007 group, we really didn't have a weakest link, which for me was great, because yes, you get an accolade, but it could have so easily have gone to anyone else. And I think you hope and you start understanding that you can now be a form of inspiration. I grew up in a South Africa that was very divided, but I was extremely privileged to have not been brought up wanting. I got given a great start in life, unlike 60-odd% of our population. So I look back and I think for my upbringing, I'm extremely grateful. But every opportunity I had to make a success of my own life was down to me and my opportunities. It wasn't down to not being able to give or have those opportunities. And I look back now and 2007 for me actually transcended the rugby field, because in 95 I was inspired, and in 2007 I get to go on and taking the cup around South Africa and going to the rural townships and seeing black youngsters in the rural townships running a kilometer or two barefoot behind the bus, just to get a glimpse of that hope, a glimpse of that inspiration. And you start realizing the honor and privilege it is to represent your country. And yes, there's a lot of pressure that comes with that. But so many people say that pressure is a privilege. And when you get to experience that pressure at that privileged of a level, you know, to grasp it with both hands was extremely important for me.
I think, you know, you've mentioned some incredible players, especially during that 2007 era, Brian. When you look back, what did you learn the most from maybe some of those kids, whether it's Smith or Matfield or Percy? You know, what did you learn most about those individuals and how to perform, you know, during that time?
So looking back at 2007 and, you know, some of the incredible individuals and players that I was lucky enough to, you know, to have played with, I think the beauty about that was that we never suppressed our own uniqueness. You know, we fully understood that as a team, we have to come together, but that we need to bring our own unique ability and not conforming to the team environment, buying into how we wanted to play, but making sure that you as an individual, you bring what is important in being able to play your part in contributing to the success of the team. Because, you know, even in the Springbok code of conduct that you say when you become a Springbok, it's that your own individual accolades will never surpass those of the team. And I think for me, you know, growing up in that environment where I had the likes of Osterrand, to Percy Montgomery, a Brayton Forster, you know, guys that were my sort of heroes coming into that Springbok setup, but being able to sort of instill the qualities, the attributes of what it means to be a Springbok, what it means to pull that green and gold jersey over your head and represent your country, and not just on the field, but off it as well. And I sort of look back now and I'm extremely grateful that I had that leadership above me that I was able to learn from, that I was able to, you know, sort of sit under and say, wow, you know, these guys have done more than just being great rugby players. They're incredible, amazing people. And, you know, for me, being able to learn as much of that as possible, not only from a work ethic perspective, a communication perspective, you know, how you deal with, you know, your fellow teammates, with people off the field. And I think John was, you know, was probably the best at it. You know, the way he was able to address his players and simultaneously also, you know, handle the pressures of the media and his communication and his verbalization of that was incredibly powerful. So, yeah, grateful for that because it allowed me to sort of be unique. It allowed me to be Brian O'Bannon, not be a Jonah Lomu or, you know, a Brayton Forster or whoever, you know, had preceded me. It allowed me to understand my uniqueness in the team, understand that I need to bring the best of me to be able to contribute to the team. And it was because I had, you know, such fantastic leaders in and around that environment.
Jake White took on a hell of a lot of pressure on his shoulders in that era. What was it about his leadership, mentoring? What made him a special coach?
So Jake had done, you know, extremely well with the younger group of players in 2002. So he had Clyde Rathbone, you know, went on to play for Australia, you know, as his captain, but he had the likes of an Ashwin Willemse, a Skalkberger, a Farida Prayer, Jean de Villiers in that group that won the under 21 World Championship in 2002. You know, I actually was fortunate enough to work under Jake in 2003 in sort of the preparation camps for the 2004 under 21 World Cup. But he then got selected for, you know, for the Springboks, and Peter de Villiers actually came in as the coach. And I think, you know, Jake, you know, brought in a sense of discipline. He brought in a sense of authority. He sort of had this, you know, school teacher, headmaster background, you know, and he was able to bring in a sense of belief. I wasn't in that first ever team meeting in Bloemfontein in 2004, but apparently it went along the lines of, you know, Jake came in, and he had the legends of Osterrand, Brayton Forster, John Smith, you know, guys who'd been a part of 2003 and the dismal occasion that that was for the Springboks. And he said that, like, one of the first things he said to them was, you know, we're going to win the World Cup in 2007. And all of a sudden you had these guys who were like, is this, like, looking at their watches? Is it April Fools? Or is this, does guy really know what, you know, what he's talking about? So Jake brought in an astute level of technicality, if I can put it like that. So, you know, he sort of started planning things 4 years ahead, you know, who he wants to sort of, or who he envisioned to be a part of that squad in 2007. You know, he had some extremely tactical advancements in bringing in someone like Dr. Cheryl Calder from an eye visual perspective, you know, that sort of trained a different mentality. You know, she'd been with England in 2003. You know, he brought in Eddie Jones, you know, just before that World Cup in 2007 to bring an outside expertise in just to, you know, bring a different approach to how we played the game. So, you know, technically, you know, Jake was extremely thorough in his approach. And people ask me a lot, you know, who's the best coach ever? You know, who's the best coach you ever played under? And I think it's a very subjective one because, you know, what do you judge based on? Is it winning a World Cup? Is it beating the, you know, the All Blacks in New Zealand twice, beating a British and Irish Lions team, you know, winning a Super Rugby? But I'm extremely grateful for Jake because, you know, he sort of selected me, I wouldn't say out of obscurity, you know, I've gone really well as a 21-year-old. And even though I'd worked with him, you know, in the year prior, you know, he told me that, you know, if I want to make it at the highest level, I've got to get bigger, stronger, quicker. I've got to be able to adapt. And, you know, I think it was in those learnings that I'm extremely grateful because, you know, he gave me a chance. You know, I'd never played Super Rugby before. I'd, you know, just come onto the Currie Cup scene. So all of a sudden it was like this 21-year-old, you know, who is Brian Abana? And, you know, for that, I'm extremely grateful to Jake. And like I say, he'd gone on this journey in terms of planning technically, you know, what he wanted to achieve in 2007, even though there were times of, you know, disarray, times of struggle and adversity, you know, Jake never lost faith in what the plan was that he wanted to achieve. And I think it was constantly being able to go back to that. You know, and as a player, to have support from a coach like that was pretty amazing.
You mentioned Dr. Cheryl Calder there. I was going to come on to her role. That whole process of incremental gains or marginal gains, and I know that you were one of her prime, you know, you wanted more from her. You went back to her. Some players could be a little bit, okay, we're doing it, but not really buying into it. You really did. And the amount of interception tries that you scored, was that directly relatable? And what did that eye vision, that eye work bring to you?
Yeah, so Dr. Cheryl Calder's the iGEM platform that she actually has created is pretty powerful. And I think my realization only came like a day or two after actually meeting her for the first time, because you sort of take for granted that, you know, things happen on the field, and I did intercept one or two balls prior to actually working with Dr. Cheryl. But it was actually then she actually told us, well, you guys go to the gym. And we're like, obviously we go to the gym. Like, we're rugby, professional rugby players, we have to go to the gym. She goes, okay, well, what's the strongest muscle in your body? And we go, well, for Osterant it might have been legs, for me it might have been my core, you know, for John Smith it might have been his arms and his chest. And she says, well, if you think about it, every decision that you are making every second of the day is coming through one muscle. And we like all sort of look confused, like, what is this doctor talking about? She goes, well, as much as you train your physical being in a gym, as much as you want to get quicker, stronger, faster in a gym, as much as you want to improve your on-field tackling and rucking and all that, why don't you want to improve the one muscle that allows you to make all the decisions that you need to make on a field? And I think sort of when that struck, when understanding that, okay, well, as much as, you know, you got to train your body and your physical specimen, if your eyes and everything that you're taking in is having to make a decision, if you can train that to make those decisions quicker and faster and better than the people around you, you know, surely you will then be an improved player. And I think it was sort of getting that realization, understanding how powerful, all of a sudden, if you can make your eyes process information quicker, and in so doing, being able to then react quicker, it was pretty powerful for me as an individual. You know, I know a lot of players around the world love working with Dr. Cheryl Calder, and she's gone beyond just the rugby environment now. You know, she's done tennis, Formula One, athletics, doing some fantastic work within the business environment, which is really great because we're sitting in front of computers the whole time. So does it correlate specifically with the, you know, increase in intercepts that I got post working with Dr. Cheryl? Probably a little bit. It definitely played its part. But, you know, a woman who, you know, became the first ever person to win back-to-back Rugby World Cups in 2003 with England and 2007 with South Africa, you know, someone I absolutely loved working with. So a huge amount of respect for Dr. Cheryl.
Just for the listeners, Brian, you mentioned iGEM, and some of them might be thinking, "What? Yeah, am I lifting weights with my eyes?" Could you just explain exactly what the iGEM was? What were the exercises you did?
Yeah, so there's a couple of technical things on a laptop or a computer or iPad. And there's really some drills on the field. So again, being able to not just see things in front of you, but able to literally, you know, expand your vision. So, you know, there'd be on-field drills where, you know, we'd have to call out colors 15 meters behind the defensive line, or, you know, we'd have to look at things differently. You know, she had this net that she brought with that literally trained your hand-eye coordination and reaction time. And then before those, the games in the 2007 World Cup, you know, just before we'd go back into the change room, I'd have like this hand-eye coordination reaction drill with her. And there's quite a few photos, and it's just literally making sure that my eyes are in tune with my hands. And I think in so doing, there's the practical aspect of it, being able to look at a computer and do the various exercises and drills, but then it's getting out onto the field and, you know, doing things like that as well. So it's a whole wide variety. There, she had this thing at her practice in Stellenbosch that, you know, gives like, it's like these, it looks like a spider web with different dots on that you have to sort of press and just try to coordinate how quickly you can get that. I don't know if I've still got the record, but I think I did have the record at a stage. So it's a wide variety set of exercises, not just on the computer, but you know, definitely pitch, you know, pitch related as well.
What does that do for your confidence when you're looking at these, I guess, these little marginal gains that you've never uncovered before, you know, like you said, in the gym, training, fitness, all that. And then something like this comes along. And how does that feel? What does that do for your belief, you know, when you're on the pitch?
Chris, for me, those small little increments in, you know, constant improvement. And Heineke Meyer actually had this saying that, you know, comes from a Japanese called Kaizen, which is, you know, continual improvement. And when you're at that highest level and, you know, the smallest percentages or the smallest margins can make the difference between winning and losing, you know, missing out on scoring a try or actually scoring a try. You know, you try to do it as best possible to make sure, you know, we call it the one percenters in the professional athlete environment. And for me, something like iGym was just that 1% that, you know, you constantly were trying to get better at. You know, it was an opportunity for me to improve and in a skill set that I had never really thought was an important one and was in so doing. And it wasn't the only thing, because there's various other components of those incremental improvements that you continually try to strive for. But yeah, it was important. You know, if you want to be the best in the world, and I sometimes get asked, like, you know, how do you find balance? And, you know, I'm like, I was the worst at finding balance. You know, I wanted to be the best rugby player in the world. And, you know, that led me focused, you know, every waking second of the day on what do I need to be the best player in the world. So, I think it was definitely within that time period. There wasn't balance for me, because, you know, throughout my rugby career, I wanted to be the best, and that constantly, you know, pushed me and drove me to want to find ways of trying to be better. So those incremental, you know, gains were extremely important. Again, kudos to Jake, you know, bringing in someone like Eddie Jones 2 months before that World Cup, someone who was a total outside influence, you know, someone who a year or two prior, you know, had been talking nonsense about us in the press, you know, when we played against Australia. So I think it was also, you know, being able to adapt and pivot, like we've seen in, you know, this year that has been 2020. If you are willing to adapt, if you are willing to pivot and innovate, I think you definitely put yourself in a much better position. So for me, those small increments are incredibly important. If you want to, you know, get to the top, you know, you can't expect to reach an end goal, you know, within a day. But if you're willing to put in those small amounts of disciplines and incremental improvements, you know, I really believe that you can eventually get to success over time.
Can we just go back to your sort of formative years and your parents? Was your dad a big rugby fan?
He was a massive rugby fan. My parents, you know, had to go through the apartheid era in South Africa, which was very different to the upbringing I potentially had to have. I think they went through a lot more struggles than what I did. But, you know, they offered us opportunities as kids to go to some fantastic schools, to not really be bound down by the then apartheid rules and regulations. And, you know, in so doing, us really give us a great foundation for hopefully making a success of our lives, not just from a sporting perspective, but from an educational perspective as well. But for a lot of the listeners who don't sort of know Brian O'Banner's background, so I named after Brian Robson and Gary Bailey. So yeah, Manchester United supporter. Grew up, you know, wanting to be the next South African export into the English Premiership, wanting to be a soccer player, wanting to, you know, emulate the likes of a Quinton Fortune, a Mark Fish, you know, all these incredible, you know, Bafana players that came to buy their trade overseas. And it was through the 95 World Cup experience that I got inspired to take up the game of rugby as a 12-year-old boy. And so, yeah, like I say, you know, the likes of U.S. Van Vestes and James Small, Chester Williams, you know, Francois Pienaar, you know, Kovacs Visser, Andre Joubert, you know, all these names in 95 that had me as a 12-year-old boy sitting in that stadium in I think it was the 24th of June, 1995, seeing this game that I had never actually understood or even played, but seeing what this group of 25 men, you know, was able to do in uniting a country sort of lit an inspiration in a 12-year-old boy to one day try emulate the same, you know, one day try hopefully play his part and giving that bit of hope, giving that bit of inspiration. So, you know, I sort of went to King Edward's the following year in 96. And yeah, believe it or not, my first ever game of rugby was for the under 14 G side at King Edward's. A, B, C, D, E, F, G side at King Edward's. So, I mean, you don't have to be a mathematician to know it wasn't quite how I envisioned the whole dream to start out. But just getting to now play a game that I'd been inspired to take up a year prior and getting to have an absolute blast on the field with 14 of my mates at 8 o'clock on those very cold winter mornings in Johannesburg was incredible. And, you know, the journey then continued. I started getting back. I couldn't pass with my left hand. I was like half the size of George Gregan. So you can imagine how small I was. But it was just amazing to now be playing, you know, playing this incredible game. And I think, yeah, like I said, it wasn't the start I imagined, but just continued working extremely hard. And with a bit of luck on the way, with a bit of support from, you know, those who believed in me, you know, I managed to get to the top.
John Smith, he spoke about tennis was his thing growing up, and he, you know, wanted to be on the, I guess, the Wimbledon centre court. Yours was football. Both of you came to the game of rugby quite late, potentially, you know, because early specialisation is quite a big subject, I think, with children taking up sport these days. Do you think it's still possible in today's era that somebody could start playing rugby at 12, 13 and still make it to the levels that you got to?
Definitely think it's still possible. I think early realisation is debatable. You know, Tiger Woods and Roger Federer's dads put a golf club and a tennis racket in their hands, I think at 2 and 3 years old, respectively. And, you know, they have achieved quite a bit. But, yeah, I think it's a difficult one. I think for me, as a youngster, being able to have an opportunity to play various different sports, you know, I went from playing cricket to rugby to soccer. I did a bit of basketball. I did a bit of athletics. You know, I played a bit of hockey at university, not very high, but I think in terms of being adaptable and learning a various set of skills was extremely important for me. So, yeah, again, you know, I talk about those incremental improvements that one has to make. I really believe rugby has got a lot more professional from a much younger age. You know, in South Africa, you got 14-year-old kids doing video analysis. I mean, I only went to gym for the first time ever when I was like 17 or 18 years old. So, you know, times have changed dramatically, and there has been a phenomenal increase, you know, in salaries, in what you can earn through professional sports. And, you know, I think that ideal or ideology that people want to strive for, and, you know, they just see that little, you know, golden carrot at the end of the rainbow, is a difficult one, because I think the biggest realization, unfortunately, comes that not everyone can become a professional rugby player, and not everyone can become a professional tennis player, not everyone can become, you know, Formula One racer like Lewis Hamilton. And it's then, if you don't make it in sport, you know, what are you able to fall back on? And I think that's potentially where a lot of younger rugby players are getting a lot better. You know, there was sort of a time period of between 15 to 20 years, you know, just after the game had become professional, you know, where because of it being a professional sport, you potentially didn't study or didn't complete your studies like I did. You know, I started studying when I came straight out of school at 17 years old, and always knew education was important, but, you know, rugby started a lot earlier than what I imagined at the professional level. So never completed my studies, and then, you know, started fast forward 15 years, and all of a sudden I had to go back into the books to just give myself a basis of understanding and competence to be able to make the transition period that little bit easier. So, yeah, I think it's trying to get that message across, is that, you know, everyone, you know, has a dream or an ambition to potentially become a rugby player or cricketer or golfer or tennis player or Formula One driver. Unfortunately, there's, you know, maybe the top 1 or 2% that actually do go on to make it. You know, and what, you know, what do you have if that ambition or realization doesn't come to fruition? And I think that's sort of the counter, you know, the counter argument to that. Yes, you know, you can, you know, work extremely hard, you can be extremely dedicated. You unfortunately need luck. You need a coach, you know, selecting you, or you need to be spotted somewhere. You know, that's been taken away from a lot of youngsters now with 2020, with, you know, no sport being played on an amateur level, you know, globally. But yeah, I mean, again, my advice would probably be to not take it too serious, because if you're taking anything seriously from a very young age, you know, you're going to have times throughout your career when you sort of look back and you're like, am I really enjoying, you know, the reason I actually started playing this beautiful game, whatever that might be.
You talk about pressure and talk about enjoyment. How did you feel pressure? Did you, and how, if you did, how did you cope with it? And did it change over your career?
Yeah, I think every time you get an opportunity to run across, you know, that line and play a game of rugby, it was a pressure situation. I think for me, and I said a lot, for me, I was comfortable in pressure because 9 times out of 10, you know, my preparation had made sure that I was then able to handle the pressure that came my way. And not just from the physical perspective, you know, but from the mental perspective as well, you know, constantly pushing your boundaries. And I think we look at sport now and it's sort of that people don't sort of see the hours of work, you know, spent off the pitch, doing video analysis, doing all this stuff, then the high intensity of training, you know, to be able to then be as prepared as possible, you know, come match day. You know, I love pressure. I love being able to be someone that, you know, my teammates look to if they wanted something to happen, or, and, you know, that really got me invigorated. It got me sort of driven to want to be the person that makes a difference, want to be the person that becomes influential. I didn't always get it right. And I think, you know, that's something else that I had to realize, you know, pretty early on in my career, is that it's not all sunshine and roses. And it's potentially in the times of adversity, in the times of struggle, in the times of negativity, that you learn a lot about yourself as not only a professional athlete, but as a person as well. And I'm extremely grateful to have had some incredible support around me, support that I trusted and valued. You know, being able to have those people around me that I could bounce ideas off, give me criticism, that I could take on the chin and learn, you know, to get better. But I love, you know, I love the position of pressure. I love being able to be put in that situation, you know, and try my best to not only adapt to it, you know, but make a, you know, make a pretty significant impact on it. So yes, there is pressure situations, not only in professional sport, in life as well. And, you know, if you prepare yourself as best possible, you know, it's then easier to try handle that. It's not always possible, but it is easier.
Gareth Thomas spoke the early stages of his career, going into his sort of first international matches, almost no rituals, no routines, just, wow, this is really cool. What a great experience, just playing rugby. And actually, the longer his career went on, obviously, you know, 100 caps, another centurion, he felt then he needed, you know, as that sort of went on, he needed some rituals, some routines to enable that stability and to keep him in the zone, to keep performing at his best. And George Gregan talks about this silencing of the noise in the stadium, but also internally as well, trying to silence the noise that goes on in between your mind. I know you said, you know, you've got some routines. What did they look like? What did it look like 24 hours before a match, 3 hours before a match? What were the things that you were doing to get yourself in that right zone to perform at your best?
Yeah, mine was probably counter to Gareth. I was probably a lot more serious in the start of my career towards, you know, than towards the end. And it was about sort of getting into, you call it the zone. It was about putting in, whether it had been music or the preparation, you know, or writing down the goals I had for that game. There were sort of those little things that I would do. But, you know, a specific thing, and I didn't put on my left boot first or my right boot first or wear a special brand of jocks. It was literally as we got to the stadium, I sort of put my bags down in the change room. I would then go into the left-hand corner of the field, you know, do a bit of stretching, do a bit of visualization in terms of what I wanted to achieve that day, and sort of put in, you know, visually, you know, what the preparation had been, you know, what do I see happening on the field, you know. And I think it was in that small routine, it was a 5 to 10 minute period that I literally did throughout the course of my career, you know, right until the time that I stopped. And again, if it didn't happen, if we were maybe late, you know, arriving at the stadium, I made sure it didn't throw me, it didn't, you know, put me under added pressure. But that was sort of something that, you know, I had sort of music in my ears, sort of visualizing, you know, Griggs talks about sort of drowning out the crowd. For me, it was getting in that moment when there was no one in the stadium, you know, sort of envision what you want to do, how you're doing, you know, go through the plays, go through what you've done in preparation this week. And that sort of 5 to 10 minute block was really key for me. And that happened throughout the course of my career. And I think it was one of the key factors in making sure that I tried to know what I'd done, knowing that what I'd done it was in the past and what I now needed to do, you know, to continually want to be a success. So yeah, there were various elements of it. I probably got a lot more relaxed. I think it went from heavy rock pop to very laid back love songs towards the end of my career.
You mentioned earlier on about criticism. How did you handle criticism? Because I imagine players these days have very different attitudes to, and it's a very different world that we live in now in terms of brutal criticism and the way that a coach handles feedback to players. It must have changed over your time as well. Did you take it personally? How did you, everyone does, don't they? How did you handle criticism?
Martin, I think I try to disseminate where that criticism comes from. And, you know, that was really important for me. You know, if it was a keyboard warrior who, or if you've never been in that cauldron, if you've never been in that pressure situation, can you really critique on it? So for me, I always try to appropriately judge where the criticism was from. You know, if it was from my inner circle, you know, from my coaches, you know, from those around me who understood the game, who knew me, you know, you take it on the chin. And, you know, I try to, as best possible, you know, make sure like the criticism doesn't negatively affect or impact the way I wanted to portray myself. You know, if there was valid critique about how I was playing, you know, what could I then go do to then improve that or to get better at in that situation? Now, if it was someone, you know, out the crowd telling me that I couldn't catch a ball, not knowing me or knowing, you know, what the, you know, what the effort and pressure situation is, you know, it was really being able to disseminate and appropriately apply, you know, where the criticism came from. I think, you know, you get criticism, you get things like being booed off the field in Bloemfontein in 2010 by 45 odd thousand South Africans, you know, and sort of looking to understand why, you know, what are you doing? And it's moments like that, moments of despair, of adversity that, you know, you sort of learn and have to dig extremely deep, you know, to try and get out of that. But it was also moments that sort of formed me. And I think, yeah, like the criticism, you know, along with that adversity, along with the disappointments, are potentially what sets, you know, those that can then go on to achieve bigger and better things, to those that just fall by the wayside.
How do you build resilience these days, Brian, whether it's, you know, on the sports pitch or actually in business, very different skill set. Yeah. How are you resilient in sort of today's market? I know your foundation has changed, the business operations that you're in, the world's been a challenging place for the last 12 months. How have you stayed resilient?
So I think the resilience for me comes in, you know, finding value in yourself before looking to the outside world to try to find that. If you're constantly going to rely on the thoughts and objectives of other people, of, you know, how they perceive you or see you, I really think that, you know, preparation plays a big key in being able to adapt and pivot and innovate. You know, if you don't know anything and you're not willing to read on or read about something or educate yourself with regards to that, so from a business perspective, you know, I sort of was fortunate enough to be able to do a bit of studying in my last year of actually playing rugby, learn some key business attributes of, you know, how to do a PowerPoint presentation, you know, how to work an Excel spreadsheet, you know, how to do things that, you know, for a businessman or woman seem pretty simple. But if you then look at a professional athlete, you never have to do your own budget. You know, you've got people doing your own, you don't have to buy your own clothes because you get given clothes. You know, all of a sudden, you know, rugby ends and I had to have a completely, you know, different wardrobe because I didn't have, you know, suits for 2 weeks on end, you know. So, you know, it's being able to adapt, being able to prepare appropriately for that, and in so doing, educate yourself to try be able to handle, you know, what comes your way. So resilience, you know, can it be taught? I think an element of it, you know, I think if you look inwards more than what you look outwards and you're able to lean on your own strengths, understand that you can improve your own weaknesses, have, again, those sounding boards around you, whether it be mentors, whether it be family members, friends in, you know, senior level executive positions that allow you to understand all these things. Be willing to learn, and never think you're better than anyone else. And hopefully in so doing, you sort of build these small traits together to then become resilient. I'll definitely be the first to say I'm probably not an expert at it, you know, given the rise of social media and, you know, having a couple of 100,000 followers on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. There's unfortunately an understanding that you're not going to please everyone, no matter how much you want to try, you are not going to please everyone. And if you can find that value in yourself, I also believe that we need to respect each other, but you also need to have respect for yourself before you can have respect for anyone else. And hopefully in putting all these little building blocks together, you know, you form this holistic resilience, which, you know, stands you in good stead.
When you moved to France and you were playing for Toulon, what did you learn from that? A very different culture, a very different, an incredible galaxy of superstars playing in there, but also just living in France. What did that bring to your life?
So my decision to move to France in 2012 was a pretty big decision. You know, much like moving from the Lions to the Bulls at the start of my career when everyone told me it was the worst decision I'm ever going to make. But it was a decision I made to, I wanted to get out of my comfort zone. I'd obviously fallen in love with the French way of life post 2007, and obviously winning that World Cup, you know, played a really important part, Martin. But yeah, that decision was made in 2012. You know, I still had dreams and ambitions of being a part of the 2015 Rugby World Cup, and I just felt that I had 9 years of Super Rugby. You know, I had 5 years with the Bulls, 4 years with the Stormers. I wanted to grow or continue growing and developing as a player, and I got given an opportunity by Bernard Laporte to like you alluded to, play with an incredible group of players and try to learn as much as possible. And I think it was decision, looking back now, in my first season we won the double, and second season we went on to win Europe 3 times in a row. So it probably wasn't a bad decision, but it also made me grow. All of a sudden you get thrown into this foreign environment where you can't speak the language, you need to adapt, you need to open yourself up to be willing to learn and engage in an environment that you would never have been exposed to previously. So the challenges of then traveling from France to play for the Springboks and continually growing. I look back now at that time in Toulon with a lot of fondness. Got to meet players that I probably had only ever played against in my career. Got to form relationships that I would have never ever formed if I had stayed in South Africa, and also got to continue developing as a rugby player, which extremely grateful for.
Your debut, and we talk about handling pressure, your debut came at in the same city that you're sitting in right now, in London in 2004. What were your memories of that day, and did it live up to your expectations?
Yeah, I get asked quite a bit, Martin, what is the best moment in my rugby playing career? And I'm so grateful and fortunate to have had so many successes, winning Super Rugby titles, winning a World Cup, beating the British and Irish Lions, winning a Tri Nations, the trophies, the tries, the memories made. But I think for me, that moment on the 20th of November, 2004 was by far, heads and shoulders above any other moment in my career. And the reason I say that is, you sort of have this dream, you have this want to try do something incredibly special to represent your country. And then for me to do it, score a try with my first touch of the ball in international rugby against the then world champions, England, at the home of rugby, Twickenham, was a pretty incredible start, to be brutally honest. It was freezing. I'll never forget, I sort of, myself and Jock Free were on the bench that day. I was actually going to play centre, so I think I was going to go on for Maurice Joubert. And as we're warming up, both Brayton Paulser and John de Villiers got injured. So I actually made my test debut at wing, even though I'd sort of been playing center for my early years. I'd sort of been warming up and I was about to run on the field with about 9 minutes to go. And our team manager called me back and sort of extremely gutted, like, you're about to make your debut and now it's not going to happen. And he said, no, you're still going out. You just need to take the beanie off your head. So it was that cold in Twickenham. I was not used to the cold, being in England for the first time ever. But that moment for me, it sort of made me taste the inspiration. It had been the realization of a dream. And yes, it started out incredibly. Probably could have only been bettered if we, went on to win that day, but we got absolutely pulverized by a pretty strong English back. And that moment for me made me just make sure that I don't want to do this once. I want to do it 10 times, 20 times, 50 times. Potentially want to be the first player of color to do it 100 times, and on en route to that, do things that no other player had done before. And it's because of that moment that I think the fire never died for as long, as long as I played, because I'd loved that opportunity. I relished the ability to represent my country and get bestowed with that privilege, but being able to get given this pressure, pressure pot, and say, well, how are you going to handle it? And that first moment for me, far outstretches any other moment in my career.
We haven't actually mentioned your 100th test, which is a pretty big part of the Rugby Centurions Club.
I don't think we need to do we?
Yeah, well, I want to introduce you because you weren't very nice to another member of the club, actually, Brian, were you on that day? I think there was a yellow card incident, possibly.
Yeah, Adam Ashley Cooper. I've watched that replay a few times. Not quite sure. Interesting yellow card, to say the least. Not quite the way I wanted my 100th test to be remembered, getting a yellow card and losing it in a game that we should have won. But yeah, still getting the opportunity. I had my wife and my then newborn eldest child with us in Australia. He was, I think, 8 weeks old. So, it's pretty special to have shared it with those closest to me. And it is different, unfortunately, just because, it is what it is. It's was sort of weird because Warren Whiteley was actually playing his first test that weekend. So sort of the two stark contrasts of a guy, getting to play his first, and me being able to be there for my 100th. So, it was a very special week, to be brutally honest. Perth had always been an extremely good hunting ground for me personally. Wasn't quite so that weekend. But I think just that privilege and honor of getting to represent your country 100 times, having gone through that journey, gone through the highs, gone through the lows, I wouldn't say it's just reward for the, you know, hard work, sacrifice, and dedication, because every professional athlete, you know, puts in the hard work, the sacrifice, and dedication. Unfortunately, like I alluded to earlier, not everyone, you know, can play 100 times for their country. In South Africa, there's, you know, only been 6 rugby players that have done it. You know, I think there'll definitely be quite a few more. But yeah, you know, extremely, you know, humbled to have gone on that journey, you know, to have had my family there, to have been made feel special, got so much love and support from around the world, and to have joined a very elite and impressive club, which, again, I'm extremely grateful for.
Do you ever think about that milestone? Do you get to 80, 85 caps, 90 caps and think, God, you know, I want to hit 100. Some players have been very shy and said, you know, game by game, you know, percentage by percentage, minute by minute, and it's not been a thing, but then arrived at that great moment. How was it for you?
I think if you sort of start looking in the distance, Chris, you potentially lose sight of the immediate future. And I think, like, you can only focus on the next job at hand, because if you're not going to look at the present, if you're not going to focus and make sure that you're, you know, applicably applying everything that's needed, you know, to be successful in the present, the long term is never going to happen. And for me, you know, again, when I played that first cap, you know, I had this dream or ambition of wanting to play 100 test matches for my country and, you know, become the first player of color to do so. But it's not, you don't just get there, you know, by luck. There's a lot of other things that have to happen. You know, I tell everyone, as much as, you know, my skill, my hard work, my sacrifice, dedication got me there, and if it wasn't for Peter de Villiers selecting me when everyone told him not to, you know, if it wasn't for Jake White picking me from obscurity, you know, Heineke Meyer's belief in me when, again, I sort of had a really bad run, but, you know, he had worked with me prior and sort of knew what he could get out of me. You know, Alistair Coetzee, who then sort of came in and, you know, still gave me an opportunity. So, yes, for me as a player, I did what was needed to try put myself in a position to be selected. But it wasn't just down to what I was doing. And like I said, there's only a small percentage that, you know, get that honor and privilege. So extremely grateful for the coaches that, you know, I had throughout my career. Extremely grateful for the medical staff that, you know, was able through injuries, not that I had many, but was able through injuries to get me back on the path. Coaches and players around me that made me look good, because, yes, I did a lot of good things, but if it wasn't for everyone else around me, I wouldn't have become the player I did or wasn't able to have achieved the things I did. So, you know, I look back at my career and I got to play 124 times for my country. There were maybe 10, 15 games in which, like, there was individual things that happened. But for the rest, it was because of the team environment I was in.
Our values, or the Centurion values, should I say, Brian, respect, resilience, selfless commitment, and courage. Which one stands out the most to you, if you could single one out?
For me, it would be respect. Actually, something I talk about, you know, with my foundation work as well. And the respect on so many different levels. So respect for yourself, firstly, that inward respect for yourself. You're then able to have respect for, you know, those around you, you know, no matter what level they are in life, you know, whether it be, you know, working as a janitor or, you know, CEOs of companies. I think if you can have respect for yourself, there automatically becomes a sense of being able to have respect for those around you. Then I think all the other traits, you know, of being Centurions and the values that, you know, we really see, you know, come to life within rugby and being a Centurion, it all for me starts with respect.
Your foundation, currently one is better than zero or one is better than nil. How has that changed over the last few years? Because I know, you know, a couple of years ago you were doing a lot of sort of leadership development with, I guess, inner city youths in London. Very much a different landscape at the moment in terms of what you're doing in South Africa. How is that movement developing, Brian?
Yeah, like you said, so I actually started the Brian O'Banner Foundation back in 2015, Chris, with the initial objective of passing on the skills of leadership to those in impoverished areas. You know, we started off with the Team O'Banner concept in London that went for 3 years running, did one in Cape Town in, you know, in 2018, 2019. But like everything, you know, this year has thrown everyone out. We've needed to adapt and pivot. And given the massive food insecurity faced by so many, particularly in South Africa, where the difference between the rich and the poor is so vast, and there's just such a big majority of our people that are struggling, you know, the food insecurity, you know, really touched my heart. I've been an ambassador for Food Forward SA, you know, for a number of years, so fully understood the opportunity that is needed. And as professional athletes, we're given the platform to make a difference. We're given that platform to be able to have your voice heard. And yeah, it's been phenomenal. I think we've given out just over 4,000 food parcels over the course of this pandemic, you know, made a difference in 20 odd thousand people's life, which again feels like a drop in the ocean in terms of the massive need. But like the website says, one is better than zero. And I'd rather be making a difference with one than to zero. You know, how will the foundation continue to adapt and change in the years to come? Not quite sure. We'll have to see what happens in 2021. But I've got a real drive to want to continue making a difference. And you know, we've seen the likes of the Khaleesi Foundation with Rachel and Sia Khaleesi, you know, Marcus Rashford over in the UK, you know, the tennis players of Novak Djokovic, Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal have given back. You know, Lewis Hamilton has been phenomenal. So Laureus, you know, which I'm an academy member, has been doing some phenomenal work over the course of the last, you know, 20 years. So yeah, you know, just using the platform to be able to make a difference in, you know, times that are extremely tough for so many. And, you know, we'll see where 2021 takes the Brian O'Banner Foundation. But at the moment, you know, just continuing to hopefully try, you know, make those small incremental differences to those who, you know, would be, you know, positively impacted by it.
Your business life, Matchkit, Pay Me Now, obviously you're a brand ambassador for a number of Rugby World Cup sponsors indeed, and also your TV and media work. How's all that going? How's the transition been? And how are you enjoying business life, I suppose?
It has been extremely invigorating, Martin. I'm extremely fortunate. Again, you know, I didn't realize while I was playing the game of rugby and developing the brand that I sort of paid a lot of focus and attention to, and you know, sort of that level of respect, Chris, you spoke about. So, and when we're going to functions and receiving business cards, you know, to not chuck that business card, in the bin come the, you know, end of the evening, but potentially, you know, stay in touch and keep in touch. So, you know, building relationships, building a brand that hopefully transcended, you know, the rugby field. And I look back now and, you know, the last 2 years have, you know, yeah, been extremely invigorating and positive, launching two different companies. The fintech company, Pay Me Now, that I'm currently head of business development for is, yeah, really cool. Actually, it's with my university roommate who was the MC at my wedding. So trusted relationship, you know, Matchkit and, you know, Retroactive, trying to create a positive impact for professional athletes around the world. So again, fortunate in the opportunities I have been able to receive post my career. I'll be the first one to say I'm far from where I want to be or what I want to achieve. But yeah, you know, getting into the structures of business, you know, works, you know, talking to impact funds and venture capitalists from around the world and having to learn that MVP isn't most valuable player, but rather minimum viable product. Yeah, so got me really good at in 2018.
And we've gone for a whole hour without talking about racing a cheetah. Now, just how did that come about, Brian? Because it is one of the most bizarre things to this day that we have ever seen. Just for the listeners, Brian sprinted along. Well, a cheetah was chasing him. I think it was for some kind of awareness campaign. But were there any safety controls involved?
Yeah, Martin, it was one of the strangest things I have ever done. It really came about by trying, you know, there was a conservation company in South Africa that, you know, looked after endangered animals and specifically the cheetah. And they just wanted to raise awareness about the plight of the cheetah becoming an extinct animal. And sort of sent this proposal through to my manager. And, you know, we sort of had, oh, this is pretty cool. It's not been done before. No one's ever raced a cheetah. And you know, sort of 2007, I was like, okay, well, I'm in. And yeah, looking back now, I'm like, Brian O'Banner, what were you thinking? Firstly, it was in midweek. I think we were playing the Crusaders in Super Rugby that weekend. Heineken Mayer was furious. I had to take every precaution. They are like, yeah, they went crazy. And then I get to this DeVault cheetah conservation environment and sort of walking there and sort of discussing, and everyone's very excited, and we sort of get there and I see they built this massive stand. I'm like, oh wow, grandstand. I'm like, okay, well, this is not what I was expecting. I'm like, okay, cool. And then they show me this patchy piece of grass. I'm like, okay, this is interesting. They're like, no, we sort of planted it 3 weeks ago. I'm like, but I'm a professional rugby. Like, yeah, have you seen how patchy this thing is? Like, no man, it'll be fine. I'm like, okay, cool. I'm running here. Where's the cheetah running? They go, well, you see that little piece of string like running down the middle of this patchy grass? I'm like, yeah. Well, you're going to be on the one side and the cheetah's going to be on the other side. I'm like, sorry, come again? It's like, there's no fence, no nothing. They go, no, well, we need to like, it needs to be a live thing and we can have cameras and international TV crew. I'm like, okay, cool. I'm like, security wise, like what happens if the cheetah takes its eyes off the lure and sees my rump as a much better piece of meat? Because now we've got like one tracker on this 110 meter track with a tranquilizer gun. I'm like, well, how good is this guy's shot? Because like me and so it was so far-fetched. luckily, yeah, everything then went well. We hopefully raised a lot of awareness for the right reasons, because potentially, people thought of Brian Abana trying to show off. I honestly wasn't trying to show off. We were just trying to raise awareness for the plight of the cheetah becoming an extinct animal. I think it's got quite a few million views on YouTube at the moment.
You're a brave man.
Very brave. Brian, just, I guess, on reflection, if you were to look back now to young Brian Abana at 12, 13, what advice would you give yourself?
Oh, 12, 13. I probably would tell a 12-year-old Brian Abana to, no matter what comes your way, don't let people influence you negatively, because in a world where we tend to focus on the negative a lot more than the positive. I mean, I had coaches at school who dropped me from the A side to the C side because I chose to go play rugby provincially rather than for my school. And it was moments like that that I then, again, sort of built me up as a person. So, yeah, it would be to make sure that you don't let negativity affect you as best possible. Educate yourself, not just from a professional sporting perspective. Read books, read as much as possible, because you go through your career as a rugby player, and if you don't understand what it's like, learn about finance and learn about various other things, you potentially do get found wanting, and you make big mistakes, because professional athletes are very easy targets, and try improve your own knowledge of the things around you, and hopefully in so doing adequately apply yourself to what needs to be to be focused on. So yeah, to the young Brian Abana, don't stop dreaming. Make sure that you work incredibly hard to achieve those dreams. And yeah, like I say, stay positive, because if you don't stay positive, no one's going to do it for you.
Brian's speed in developing his life after rugby looks set to match his pace on the pitch. Join us next Thursday for another chat with one of the legends of the game. In the meantime, please head to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or Google Podcasts to leave a review and rate the show. And you can also now listen to the program and see who else we've had on the show over the past few months via the official website, rugbycenturions.com/podcast.